As the Egyptologist Toby Wilkinson tells us, quote, "Vindication before the divine tribunal required more, however, than a mere denial of wrongdoing. It involved a fundamental assessment of a person's true worth, a weighing of their good and bad deeds in order to arrive at a balanced judgment of their character. Only those who passed this calculation of differences were deemed fit to join Osiris and live forever," end quote. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Va'era, Pharaoh's Telltale Heart. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World, is generously sponsored by Ivan Kaufman. Rabbi Soloveitchik's podcasts and essays on the Book of Exodus are generously sponsored by Karen and Alec Taylor. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Sheldon Lerman.
It is one of the most famous short stories of American literature. Edgar Allan Poe describes a man who plans and commits a murder, burying the body beneath the planks of the floor. The character tells us in the tale, "It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night." The crime is brilliantly planned and executed with nary a shred of evidence implicating the guilty party, and yet, as the murderer is interrogated by the police, he is ultimately undone by a sound that is very real to him, but which, he insists, is not emerging from his head. Quote, "The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness, until at last I found that the noise was not within my ears." So the murderer reflects, and yet the murderer continues, "The noise is only heard by him, driving him to distraction." Quote, "I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated upon the boards, but the noise arose above all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God! No, no, they heard, they suspected, they knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die, and now again, hark, louder, 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 louder." At this point, the murderer identifies the sound with a part of the body, assuming that it came from the man whom he had killed. In agony, the murderer confesses the crime. "Villains," I shrieked, "dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Hear, hear. It is the beating of his hideous heart." What are we to make of this story? The point, as many suggest, is that actually the beating noise comes not from the victim, but rather from within the murderer himself. It is his own heart that is torturing him. Poe is making a distinction between head and heart, between utility and emotion, craftiness and conscience. The crime was planned by the murderer's mind, and brilliantly so. From the moment it, quote-unquote, entered my brain. But the heart, the seat of his conscience, bothers him. The ringing, which the murderer rightly reflects did not come from, quote-unquote, within my ears, came instead from his heart. It is, in other words, the murderer's own heart, which is beating in guilt, so powerfully reflecting that some aspect of his conscience remains, hence the title given to this story, The Telltale Heart. This title could equally serve as the name of our reading this week. It is easy to study our parasha and to fix our fascination on the many plagues that the Almighty brings upon Egypt, but what is perhaps even more important is the way in which Pharaoh responds to these plagues. For throughout the reading, there is a constant reference to one aspect of his anatomy, a heart that for us is truly telltale, not only in what it tells us about the king of Egypt, but also about the vision proclaimed by the Torah to the world. Let us briefly summarize the opening of the parasha. Moses, sent again to proclaim to Israel the imminence of the redemption, is ignored by the exhausted slaves. In despair, he asks the Almighty how he could possibly succeed in his mission to the royal court. He says, "Behold, the children of Israel will not listen to me. How then will Pharaoh heed me, and I am with uncircumcised lips?" This need not mean that Moses has a speech impediment. Rather, as Ibn Ezra explains, Moses sees himself as unskilled in the art of political persuasion. God, in turn, offers no answer. The implication is that the ultimate exodus of Israel will not occur because Pharaoh will be convinced that releasing the slaves is in his political interests. Soon after, the Almighty emphasizes that, in fact, Pharaoh will stubbornly refuse to free Israel. And God, in his description, singles out one aspect of the pharaonic anatomy. "And the Lord said unto Moses, See, I have made you as a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, will be your prophets. You shall speak all that I command to you, and Aaron your brother will speak unto Pharaoh that he must send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and increase my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. It is not initially clear what the Almighty means when he speaks of hardening Pharaoh's heart, but this signals that the nature of Pharaoh's heart will be central to the story. As Moses is sent to the royal court, he is informed by the Almighty that Aaron will perform a wonder with his staff, the creation of a creature called in Hebrew a tanin. Pharaoh's magicians, in turn, create such a being as well, but Aaron's miraculous creature swallows theirs. We shall return to this famous, but often misunderstood, story. For now, let us note the way the saga of the plagues begins. And the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh's heart is heavy. He refuses to let the people go. With this, the plague of blood is brought into being. Note that whereas originally the Almighty spoke of Pharaoh's heart being hardened, here a different Hebrew word is used, kaved, denoting its weight. Recently, many writers on Exodus have noted how an understanding of Egyptology allows us to intuit the larger message here, and it is to Egyptology that we must turn. As I noted in Bible 365, the king of Egypt was seen as the intermediary between the people and Maat, the goddess of order and justice. In his role, the pharaoh preserves the orderly rhythm of Egyptian economic and social life, and this theology is the heart of the country's tyranny. The Koran Hertag Tanakh of the Land of Israel edition of Exodus explains, quote, Maat was a powerful social and political instrument through which the ancient Egyptian king governed. As an all-encompassing deified concept, Maat secured the king's position as the one and only sovereign of Egypt, and Maat enabled the upper classes to maintain their social status and in some respect forced the various parties of Egyptian society to obey and accept their respective places within the society. End quote. The plagues, in other words, are meant to challenge Pharaoh's role as the guarantor of order. But the role of Maat looms large not only in Pharaoh's position, but also in the Egyptian understanding of the judgment of every individual in the afterlife. According to Egyptian belief, it was Maat that determined whether one deserved to enter the next world, which is overseen by the god Osiris. This determination took place in the presence of Osiris himself, immediately after one's death. As the Egyptologist Toby Wilkinson tells us, quote, vindication before the divine tribunal required more, however, than a mere denial of wrongdoing. It involved a fundamental assessment of a person's true worth, a weighing of their good and bad deeds in order to arrive at a balanced judgment of their character. Only those who passed this calculation of differences were deemed fit to join Osiris and live forever, end quote. This determination as to moral worth was depicted through one of the most well-known Egyptian images. The hieroglyph denoting the goddess Maat was a feather. Thus, the deceased was believed to be judged by having his or her heart, the embodiment of the soul and of human character, weighed against the feather of Maat. Wilkinson further comments, quote, in a society as obsessed with bureaucracy and accountancy as ancient Egypt was, it is perhaps not surprising that theologians imagined the weighing of a person's worth taking place on a giant set of goldsmith scales. The accuracy of the balance perfectly expressed the unerring judgment of the divine tribunal. A spell from the coffin text describes the scales as that balance of Ra on which Maat is lifted up, indicating that the judgment is authorized by Ra himself, god of the sun and of creation, and that the deeds of the deceased are to be weighed against Maat, the goddess of truth. End quote. This image is found today elaborately sketched on papyri, remnants of copies of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The heart of one who has died is weighed against the feather of Maat, with the afterlife assured only if the heart itself is not too heavy. Wilkinson again, quote, in time the heart itself came to stand for the deceased in his deeds, and the pictorial representation of the weighing of the heart against the feather of truth became an essential image on funerary papyri, an encapsulation of the final judgment. It remains one of the most instantly recognizable, characteristic, and evocative scenes from the entire repertoire of ancient Egyptian art, end quote. Thus, as many note, for God in Exodus to speak of the heaviness of Pharaoh's heart is for him to use an image that is initially incomprehensible to us today, but which would be relatively easy to understand in ancient Egypt. To say that Pharaoh's heart is heavy is to express Pharaoh's moral guilt. There is, however, much more to say here. The point, I think, is not, as some modern commentators suggest, that God is emphasizing that Pharaoh will be denied paradise in the afterlife. Something important is being said about the here and now, and further delving into Egyptology allows us further insight. Let us study the references to the king's heart. The plague of blood is followed by frogs, and when that infestation ceases, we are told, when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he made his heart heavy and did not listen to them. Here again, Pharaoh's heart is described in terms of heaviness, a word that, as we have seen, denotes his guilt. But then, after the plague of lice, a new verb appears, and Pharaoh's heart was made strong. Heaviness, as we have seen, is linked to the myth of Maat. But what does it mean for Pharaoh's heart to be strengthened? This verb appears again soon after. While Pharaoh's heart is described as heavy after an attack by wild animals and a plague that kills livestock, suddenly, after boils afflict the Egyptians, we are told, and the Lord strengthened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not hearken to them. At this point, the verse explicitly signifies not only that Pharaoh's heart is being made strong, but also that it is God who is doing the strengthening. The same phrase appears in the very last verse of the parasha, following the divinely directed hailstorm that destroys the crops. And Pharaoh's heart was strengthened, and he did not send out the children of Israel. The larger meaning of this image, the strengthening of a heart, can only, I think, be truly understood in the context of and as a response to Egyptian belief. Wilkinson tells us that Egypt believed in its ability to prevent the heart from being telltale on the day of judgment, revealing the guilt of the deceased. He writes, quote, "To counter this awful risk, powerful magic was required. Somehow the heart had to be prevented from blurting out untruths or hidden truths that might seal its owner's fate. The ingenious solution was a new type of amulet, first introduced into burials in the late Middle Kingdom. It took the familiar shape of a scarab beetle, a potent symbol of rebirth because young beetles hatch from a ball of dung, emblematic of death and decay. But unlike other scarab amulets, this one had a human head and was engraved with a protective spell addressed to the heart. After the body had undergone mummification, the heart scarab was placed over the heart with clear instructions as to how the organ should behave at the moment of truth. Do not stand against me. Do not witness against me. Do not oppose me in the tribunal. Do not incline against me." End quote. Egypt, in other words, believed its brilliance and magical technology could overcome even the final judgment itself. Strikingly, the very amulet that would be utilized for burial featured the shape of a scarab with a human head. It was just such an ingenious invention that was thought to trick the heart and ensure immortality for the deceased. Intended or otherwise, the symbolism of the head amulet bespeaks a purported triumph of head over heart, mind over morality. The amulet embodies, in other words, the Egyptian belief that the heart could be weakened, prevented from revealing its quote-unquote hidden truths, made mute, unable to reveal the true character of an individual in which it had resided. Egyptians believed that it could prevent the terror of a telltale heart. All this allows us a new way of unpacking what is occurring in our reading. Even as Egypt is destroyed by the plagues, Pharaoh continues to refuse to free Israel. This because God has, quote, strengthened Pharaoh's heart. The phrase has profoundly perturbed medieval Jewish commentators, as this seems to imply that Pharaoh's freedom of choice had been removed, which is indeed the assumption made by Maimonides. But for the Italian rabbi Ovadia Soforno, Pharaoh was not totally unfree. Rather, God removed only his power of prudence, allowing whatever was in Pharaoh's heart to dominate. At a certain point, in other words, it became obvious to all of Pharaoh's court that from a purely prudential perspective, Israel had to be released. But Pharaoh's utilitarian perspective was taken away. God, we are told, strengthened Pharaoh's heart. He acted not through his practical mind, but through his essential character. Pharaoh could have still agreed to release Israel, but only if he believed in his heart that he should. In a certain sense, God was actually ensuring Pharaoh's moral choice. If this is the case, then the story of Pharaoh's telltale heart involves an ironic reversal of the world of pagan myth. The Egyptians believed that their own magical power could weaken the heart, that the essence of human character could be disguised. God, in turn, ensured that Pharaoh's heart was strengthened and hardened. It was impervious to attempts to weaken it, ensuring that its true nature would be revealed. This approach, that the entire story should be understood as a reversal of Egyptian myth, allows us to suggest something new in addressing an old question. What precisely was the creature that Aaron's staff brought into being? Many assume that it was a serpent, but the Hebrew here is not nachash, the word for snake, but tanin, which in the Tanakh refers to a dragon-like or crocodilian creature. Thus, many modern scholars, from Umberto Casuto onward, assume that it was indeed a crocodile that emerged out of the staff of Aaron. But given the emphasis on how the miraculous animal swallowed up those produced by Pharaoh's court, a hint that it may be a slightly different creature can be found in the very same image of the afterlife from copies of the Book of the Dead. There, poised underneath the scale, is a demonic being with the head of a crocodile, but the body of other animals. This is what Egyptians called Amit the Devourer, the guardian of Osiris's realm, who yearns to devour the hearts of those found unworthy by the scales of Maat. For Aaron's staff to transform into such a crocodilian-devouring creature or something akin to it, and for this being to swallow up to devour those produced by Egypt's magicians, would lend new meaning to God's words to Moses, "Behold, I am making you as a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron will be your prophet." Pharaoh, in other words, operated in the world of Egyptian paganism and assumed that he answers only to Osiris in the afterlife, and that his civilization's genius would ensure his immortality. But no, God reveals that it is in this world that he would first be judged. In this world, his heart would be weighed. In this world, he would be found guilty by Moses, the representative of the one true God. And in this world, Pharaoh's empire would be devoured. All the brilliance in the Egyptian head could not prevent justice from being done when the true essence of the pharaonic heart was revealed. The Bible thus teaches us a lesson that is at once political and moral, one which would have enormous impact on the world, that the royal ruler is not above God and his moral law, that the genius of a society, all its magic and its technology, cannot ensure its immortality, and that as practically brilliant as a ruler might be, it is the heart, one's character, that is the essence of leadership. As Leon Kass has reminded us, we are meant to ponder whether our own society is so impressed with its ingenuity that our arrogance leads to the subversion of morality itself. Similarly, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, commenting on the tradition of many Jews to beat their chests during the recital of the Yom Kippur confession, wryly reflected that perhaps it is our heads that should be beaten. After all, he explains, in our hearts, Jews understand that holiness and the good is what truly matters, but our own emphasis on utilitarian considerations all too often cause us to choose head over heart, practicality over conscience. There are many interpretations of Poe's strange and striking story. Some suggest, for example, that it was a cricket-like chirping of an insect that the criminal misinterpreted. But in the end, the simplest explanation is best. The protagonist of Poe's tale, whose evil plan entered his brain, was undone when he became, if you will, heart of hearing. The story inspires us to study Exodus anew and to reveal ancient lessons that are as relevant as ever. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, signing off.